The Guardian.
You're listening to a Guardian Live event. The Guardian has always been a community of readers, journalists, and contributors. And now our live events are bringing these people together.
The Guardian events are The Guardian at its best, which is a two-way conversation involving the reader and having a real, genuine, thriving debate.
Could be anything from food and culture, arts, to politics, to foreign affairs. Guardian members can attend from the very serious to the quite frivolous.
Support The Guardian's independent journalism and experience it firsthand. To see what events are coming up and to check out the benefits of membership, go to members.theguardian.com.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Live podcast, dedicated to all our live events. This Guardian Live event, Yanis Varoufakis and Paul Mason in conversation, was recorded at Central Hall, Westminster, London in October 2015. Here's economist and journalist Paul Mason.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Paul Mason. I am the economics editor of Channel 4 News and the producer of a forthcoming documentary about the Greek situation called This Is a Coup. On my right is probably the only left-wing politician in Britain who can draw a crowd bigger than Jeremy Corbyn. It was 3 days before Syriza won the election in January 25th. 2015, that I first met Yanis Varoufakis, and he told me, off the record, as you often do, that he was about to become finance minister. Now, this was a shock, not just to me, but to many people who were then covering Greece, because while Syriza, the left-wing party that would then take power, was a Marxist party that had moved, in many people's eyes, to a more moderate and a more parliamentary form of political activity, Yanis was somebody from the socialist tradition in Greece who had moved to the left, certainly in the eyes of many in the financial markets, who woke up to this fact. In the 2000s, Yanis, as a professional economist and academic, was one of a handful of global economists who had identified that the structured finance boom, as we call it, the credit boom, was unsustainable, and indeed wrote so. He was an advisor to the Greek socialist leader, George Papandreou, resigning in 2006. And for all this background, some of you might be interested to know that at the moment when he was announced finance minister, many people in his own movement and the Greek left, wider Greek left, identified him as a neoliberal, as somebody who was the most likely person to sell out and surrender in the face of pressure. In the end, it worked out differently. The self-styled erratic Marxist became finance minister on January 26th, I think it was, led the negotiations that you probably all followed on the internet and on TV, which dominated everybody's lives for about 6 months, and resigned, stroked, was sacked. We'll find out the full story. On July 6th, the morning after his party had won a 61% majority to reject the deal on offer from the lenders to Greece. So without more ado, we'll be talking for about just under an hour, and then it'll be over to you for questions. I'd just like you to welcome once more Yanis. Yanis, what went wrong? What went wrong in Greece? Your mastermind specialist subject.
Well, it all began with the Persian Wars. And that botched battle, naval battle in Salamis. No, seriously. It all started going wrong. The moment we entered a monetary union, which was never designed to sustain the shockwaves of a major financial crisis. We entered that monetary union as the flimsiest part of that edifice. The shockwaves came in 2008, and the flimsiest part, Greece, became the canary in the mine. In 2010, late 2009, early 2010, the Greek state went bankrupt. And how did the powers that be in Brussels, in Frankfurt, in Berlin, in Athens respond to this bankruptcy? By piling on the weak shoulders of the most bankrupt state the largest loan in human history, on condition of austerity that would shrink the income from which the old new loans and the new loans would have to be repaid. It takes about the intelligence of a 10-year-old to realize that this cannot end well. And we were elected in 2015, being catapulted from 4%. We were the party of the radical left that had a 4%. We were catapulted to 40%. Why? Not because suddenly Greeks had an epiphany and they all became radical left-wingers. No. The reason was because the policies that were being implemented between 2010 and 15 were a catastrophic, spectacular macroeconomic failure, the largest macroeconomic failure in the history of the world after 1945. And in a sense, the reason why I took up this position, and Alexis Tsipras offered it to me, was the purpose was very simple. To look our creditors in the eye and say to them, you've been extending and pretending. You've been pretending you're solving this insolvency problem by means of huge loans on conditions of austerity, when in reality, you can never help any bankrupt entity, person, corporation, nation, get out of the bankruptcy by means of new loans on conditions that reduce income. So we're not going to do another such loan with you. We are going to stand our ground, and we're going to rage against the dying of the light in a society which was being depleted of hope, in a society that lost hundreds of thousands of its best educated young people to emigration, in a society that was losing its dignity on a daily basis. That's what went wrong.
Right, and then you took power and you went through this for initial confrontation in February. We saw the European Central Bank pull the ordinary lending to the Greek banks, leaving them on life support. February the 20th, we're in Brussels. You have to make this partial climb down. But you do, you make the climb down. And the scene is set then for a long period of negotiation. Looking back on that, tell us briefly, it didn't come out well for either Greece or for Syriza, the party you represented. Why did Syriza fail in its mission to resist austerity?
Paul, the period between January and June and our capitulation in early July can be described very simply as a war of attrition against us. The Central Bank of Europe played a significant role, as you mentioned. They were effectively asphyxiating us. It was a kind of, if you want, funding waterboarding, fiscal waterboarding. You put the head of the person that you want to subdue in the water, you bring them out just for a few seconds to have a few gasps of air, and then you put them back in the water until they succumb. Now, the situation, however, was not as bad as that, in the sense that we had weapons that we could use. We didn't use them.
What like?
What weapons?
What weapons did you have that you didn't use?
Well, look, well before we won government, we had a number of meetings and we planned the way in which we would resist this war of attrition. We had three fundamental weapons. Exiting the Eurozone was not one of them. It was never part of our repertoire. It was not our objective. We can discuss why later if you want. Our objective was to resist within the Eurozone until the costs to the other side of waterboarding us would be greater than the benefits. The weapons that would achieve that were three. First, there was a part of our debt, 27 billion, which is not a very large part of the debt, but it was a significant part of the debt, that was parked on the books of the European Central Bank. It was the only part of our debt which was written in Greek law, and that makes an important difference, because debt that is in English law, if you try to haircut it or to restructure it, then you have to answer to a British court, a court here in London or a court in New York. You know the story with Argentina. But that 27 billion was Greek government debt written in Greek law, which means that I had the capacity as the Minister of Finance to restructure it, to postpone by 20 years its repayment, and then the ECB would have to contest my decision in a Greek court, and I would have won, I can assure
you. Which we should remind people that Greek courts don't act very fast.
Yes, and that's the one occasion where this delay with inefficiency would be a godsend. So, and the reason why this was an important weapon was because the only reason why the euro still exists today is because Mario Draghi, the president of the European Central Bank, who's a very smart man and a very efficient central banker, who has to work within appalling rules and terrible constraints, he understands that, has saved the euro. And he saved it through a kind of quantitative easing like you had here in Britain, you still have, that was far worse than the QE here, but at least it saved the euro. The problem that Draghi faced was that the Central Bank of Germany, which belongs to the, it's part and parcel of the European Central Bank, was constantly on his case, constantly trying to undermine him. They even took Draghi and the European Central Bank to the Constitutional Court of Germany in Karlsruhe, effectively asking the German judges, the German Central Bank is asking the German judges to rule that the Central Bank, through quantitative easing, was effectively violating the German Constitution. And if the German judges agreed, effectively that would stop QE in Europe and that would end the Eurozone. Why am I telling you this? Because the Central Bank's defense in the Constitutional Court of Germany was, yes, we are buying debt against our charter, but don't worry about it because it will never be written down and it will never be restructured. So if we restructure that small amount, relatively small amount, that effectively would be adding fuel to the case of the Bundesbank and the whole of the Eurozone would be in jeopardy. That was a major weapon we had. Yeah. And we had an agreement with the Prime Minister and with the inner cabinet, what I call the war cabinet, that we would use it the moment the war of attrition reached the stage where they would shut down our banking sector. But when they did shut down our banks, and I reminded my colleagues, my comrades, that we had agreed we would unleash that little weapon that we had, they vetoed it and they said no. And
at that point,
we surrendered.
When you say they vetoed it, this is...
The inner cabinet.
The Prime Minister of Greece, Alexis Tsipras, and the other senior members of that.
You know how these things work. There is an inter cabinet. There is a very free and frank exchange amongst the members of that inter cabinet. In the end, the Prime Minister must decide whether he goes with one side or the other. And clearly he decided to veto the use of that particular weapon.
You just had a 61% mandate to resist. So why did that happen? I mean, even...
Well, that was before the referendum. That was at the end of the month of June when they shut down our banks.
Yeah. So at that point, you don't want to press the...
Look, at that point, I knew that we were on the path to surrender. And let's be clear about this. Let's not beat about the bush. We have a lot of important things to discuss. We should be looking to the future. We're in London. Europe is in turmoil. Britain is experiencing a mini... renaissance politically through Jeremy Corbyn. I think we should move on to the future.
Of course.
But what really matters, and this is why I'm taking a shortcut here, is that by the end of June, I'm afraid that my colleagues had already decided to give in. And the referendum, in a sense, was called to be lost. It was an escape pod, an escape route. The hope was, the prognosis was, by the majority of the inner cabinet, that the Greek people, under the fear that the bank closures would have created, would vote yes.
But
the Greek people voted no.
That's quite a serious thing.
An incredibly courageous decision.
Yeah, it's quite a serious thing to say, though, isn't it? That a political leadership of a major country basically staged a referendum that it wanted to lose. I mean, what evidence do you have?
Look, it's very simple. Let me tell you this. By the end of June, my side had made concessions to the Troika that went against everything, all my recommendations, which I consider to be concessions that would not bring about an honourable agreement, a viable agreement. I was sure that it wouldn't even bring about any agreement because the Troika wanted to humiliate Alexis Tsipras and our government. We are back in the realm of 19th century brutish power plays, not in the realm of democratic Europe, I'm afraid. So my prognosis was, my prediction was that even if you offer them austerity, they will not give you a package that we can present to the Greek Parliament, look at them in the face and say to them that this is viable. And in the end, this is exactly what happened. At that point, Alexis Tsipras had no alternative but to call for a referendum in order to show that his defiance was genuine, and I believe it was, but then to use the yes vote that would be extracted from the Greek people out of the fear that the bank closures would create to say, well, I tried, the Greek people said yes, what can I say? I recommended no. But the Greek people were not subdued by it. I have to say, I was surprised. I expected that a whole week, a full week of closed banks would bend the Greek people to the Troika's will. They were not bent to the Troika's will. I was elated that night of the referendum. It was, I think, one of the happiest moments of my life. Unfortunately, my side, the inner cabinet and the prime minister collapsed and surrendered.
And yet the Greek people, 2 months later, fast forward to, through the deal, through the summer, the government falls because its own left wing leave it, 25 MPs leave. You yourself say you won't join that new party, but you don't want to take part anymore. You didn't vote Syriza in last election. The Greek people voted yet again in September for Tsipras to be prime minister, or despite all this. And in a way, don't you feel that they had a longer... They were playing a longer game. They want a left government, whatever the international community wants it, forces onto it. Do you not think that by sticking maybe with Syriza in power, something more could have been achieved?
No, I don't think so. Look, firstly, a simple arithmetic fact. On 20th September, 1.6 million fewer people voted than they did in the referendum. That's in a country of 8 million voters. 1.6 who had voted in July did not vote in September. Secondly, and that is very important, Paul, those who voted for Syriza in September did not vote for Syriza with the spirit, the mindset, the psychology that they voted for the no vote in July or for Syriza in January. Let me put it briefly. If you had a choice between being tortured by an enthusiastic torturer or by somebody who does not believe in torture, but he fears that if he doesn't torture you, somebody worse will torture you, or that he will get tortured himself, whom would you choose? The Greek people rationally chose Tsipras over the conservative opposition.
And before we leave, you know, it's worth saying that if you look back at the time your party said was scaremongering, fearmongering, generally sort of quite, you know, right-wing demagogy from your political opponents, the New Democracy Party, the Conservatives of Greece. If you look back at it, a lot of what they predicted came true. They said, these guys are populists, that they are going to promise you things they cannot deliver, they'll lead you into a clash with Europe, and then it will all go wrong. And to be honest, Antonis Samaras, who's now given up the leadership of the Conservatives, you look back at some of his speeches, he was quite prescient, wasn't he?
Well, in 1940, when we said no to Mussolini, lots of people predicted that that would end up in an occupation that would be brutal. It will give rise to hundreds of thousands of deaths. It did. Does it mean that the fascists in 1940 were prescient? Maybe they were. But so what?
And you compare the level of resistance. I mean, in other words, this is a long, long story for Greece.
Look, all I'm saying is that it was a fight that we had to give. We had to fight that battle for a very simple reason. We were in a great depression for 7 years, which was continuing. Samaras was disingenuous, like Troika disingenuous in claiming that at the end of 2014, Greece was on the path of recovery. That was not the case. Real GDP started picking up by 0.2%. Well, let me tell you this. If I were a proper politician, I would say that I was more successful as a finance minister than my predecessor, because real GDP during my reign, 6 months in the ministry, went up by 0.8% compared to 0.2%. You know, a proper politician would say, see, I doubled and trebled the growth rate that I inherited. Now, there was no growth rate. What had happened in 2014 was that the Great Depression got greater. So what was going on was this. Incomes were sliding, continue to slide, in euros, in pounds. But average prices were falling even faster. Real GDP, do you know what it is? It's a ratio. On the numerator is in, you know, the total income in euros or in pounds. The denominator is average prices. When the denominator rises faster than the numerator, okay? But, sorry, when the denominator falls faster than the numerator is falling, the ratio is going up. But what is happening is incomes are coming down, prices are coming down faster. Why? Because you have a deflationary Great Depression. They celebrated that towards the end of 2014 as a success story. Now, the Greek people were not conned. They voted us in to fight their corner, to do something really simple, something completely non-left-wing, just common sense, to go to the creditors and say, you want milk from this cow that is called Greece? The cow is sick. If you keep beating it, it will die. You're not going to get any milk. Help restore its health to get some milk back. This is effectively our message.
Yeah.
That was our message to the Troika. The problem was that the Troika didn't care about getting its money back.
Yeah.
They cared far more about demonstrating to the people of Spain, Ireland, France, Italy, Portugal, and by extension to the people of Britain, that if you dare elect a government that doesn't toe the line, this is what you get.
You kind of preempted my next question, which is, what do you think the whole experience tells us about the European project? And you want to look forward. Greece happened. You know, Greece has happened. What would anybody who wanted to maintain the European project do in the light of what happened to you?
You have a referendum coming up soon. You're facing a dilemma. My message and the lesson from the Greek crisis is simple yet rich, in the sense that it's not black and white, but it's not complicated. My message is this. Those of us who disdain the democratic deficit in Brussels, those of us who detest the authoritarianism of a technocracy which is incompetent technically and contemptuous of democracy politically, those of us who are most critical of Europe have a moral duty to stay in Europe, fight for it, and democratize it.
Until what? Until what? Forever?
Forever is a very long time. Allow me to say this, Paul. In 1929, there was a major Wall Street collapse. The debt bubbles that the financial sector had created internationally imploded. Very soon after that, the common currency of that era, which was the gold standard, began to fragment. Britain was the first to get out, quite cleverly, in 1931. But that started competitive devaluations. It brought about the Great Depression, the inability of the political elites to coordinate their actions gave rise to the hell of the 1940s. Mm-hmm. 2008, we had an implosion in Wall Street. Financialization started collapsing. Very soon after that, the common currency of Europe, the euro, began to fragment. And within a year, proud nations turned against each other, with the Germans hating the Greeks hating the Germans, everybody hating the French. And then very soon after that, the Greeks turning against the Greeks, the Germans turning against the Germans. We are now moving towards the fragmentation of the European Union, which, in spite of the grave demerits that it is replete with, if we allow this process for fragmentation to continue, the only people who are going to benefit are the ultra-nationalists, the bigots, the racists, and those who profit from a great depression that spreads throughout the continent. Mm. You do not want in this country to see the working poor of Germany turn into unemployed poor in Germany. This will be an ominous development for the whole of Europe, for peace in the world, especially at a time when the global economy is suffering from Europe's inability to get its act together. So until when should we try to democratize Europe in order to stabilize the social economy of Europe? Until we succeed.
Now, what does democratize mean? I mean, I wrote a mildly critical article about the power structure of Europe, and all kinds of MEPs wrote to me pointing out that the Commission is now under the control partially of the Parliament, and the ECB is only constructed of delegates from national central. But it looks quite democratic compared to, you know, even some so-called democratic states. What is it that you want to change about the structure and the constitution of Europe that would allow it to, as you say, democratize itself?
Do you remember what Tony Benn used to say about this? That in a democracy, you have to be able to look at the people who have power over you and ask them a number of very simple questions. What powers do you have? Who gave them to you? How are you using them? On whose behalf are you using them? And how can we get rid of you? Yeah? To have democracy, it's not enough to have elections. You must have a body politic which is represented by a sovereign parliament which can ask these questions of its rulers and can get rid of them. Hmm. Now, the greatest economy in the world at the moment is the Eurozone in terms of size, complexity, importance, and so on and so forth. It is run by the Eurozone, and it's run by the Eurogroup, right? Now, I can assure you that these decisions are made in a way that if you knew... It's a bit like sausages. If you know what's in it, you don't want to touch it. If you knew how the Eurogroup operates, if the German citizens, French citizens, and this is what I'm up to these days, I'm trying to create mischief throughout Europe by effectively being a whistleblower and telling them what goes on in there on their behalf. Would you believe it that there are no minutes taken so that you citizens of Europe can never find out what their representative said on their behalf? Would you believe that the ministers of finance sitting around that large rectangular table make decisions on Greece, on Portugal, on Spain, on France, without having been briefed about the data or the proposals that are being put before them to decide upon? Never briefed. Once I suggested that I send by email to the other ministers of finance my proposals regarding the bailout deal. And I was warned that if I do that, it would be casus belli, a cause for war. And any proposal that I emailed to my fellow ministers of finance would be disqualified from the conversation.
Why?
I never understood the answer to that question. I put it to them, and I was told by Dr. Wolfgang Schäuble, the German minister of finance, that if I did that, he would then have to be obliged to submit my proposals to the Bundestag, the federal parliament in Berlin, which I didn't think was such a disaster anyway. And then if that happened, a debate on my proposals would begin in the Bundestag before we had it in the Eurogroup, which would mean that we wouldn't be able to have it in the Eurogroup. And if you do it, then I'm never going to discuss these proposals with you. This contempt for the parliamentary process, for transparency, is part and parcel of the democratic deficit. Now, let me put it differently. Here in Britain, you know, you have a system of government that leaves much to be desired. Yet, you know, when George Osborne takes a decision, he has to appear in front of the House and defend it. And the House of Commons has the authority to dismiss him. Now, when we decide in the Eurogroup, we are the government, the economic government of the Eurozone, yeah? We make a decision based on precisely zero information. The decision has already been made behind closed doors in dark corners of those terrible buildings. We all then meet. The representatives of the Troika speak first. So first is the commissioner, Mr. Moscovici, who speaks on any subject, Portugal, Greece, whatever. Then the president of the central bank. Then the managing director of the IMF, which is not even part of Europe. Yeah? And then the ministers on the basis of what they heard, not on any documents that they have in front of them, on the basis of what they heard from the Troika, have 10 minutes each to say some inanity, because you can't say anything serious when you are not briefed. And anyway, there's no negotiation. This process lasts for about half an hour, maybe two, and then we spend 3 hours debating the only thing to which we're contributing, the press release. Yeah? And that's how European law and European economic policy decide. Then everybody comes out and nobody defends it. Yeah? So the Spanish finance minister goes to Spain, goes to Madrid, goes to his parliament. And if somebody says to him, but what was this idiocy that you agreed upon at the level of the Eurogroup? You know what he says? Oh, it was the best I could do, you know. I was only one, there were 18 against me. But everybody says that. Schäuble goes to the Bundestag. He defends himself by saying, oh, this is the best I could do. So in the end, nobody's responsible.
You're not giving a great advert for this thing. You want to stay in, though, are you? I mean, in the sense that, what would it look, surely then, for it to be democratized means that, I mean, in a way, it puts you on the same side as Schäuble. Schäuble has been banging on that, you know, the only way this thing is going to work is to centralize it. Then at least we can see where the power is, and it can take effective decisions. That needs fiscal union, it needs banking union, ultimately. Germans are only going to have it on the basis of everybody being solvent. And so you almost argue, if you want to maintain it, you're going to have a German-designed euro system.
No. Simple. No. That we need to have a proper democratic federation, there's no doubt. But a proper democratic federation is exactly the opposite of that which you described. Look, let me, don't tell anyone, we're just a small group of people here. Let's just keep it amongst ourselves. Through my conversations with Dr. Schäuble, I can assure you that he convinced me that in principle he would agree with the idea of a democratic federation. But then he adds, but this is politically impossible. And then he falls back on plan B, on the second best, which is not the second best. It's a tragedy. It's a nightmare. It's a dystopia. Which is what? Instead of having this group of 18 people who are rudderless and completely informal, you know, the Eurogroup, by the way, doesn't exist. Did you know that? I didn't know it. I found out that it doesn't exist when, in the Eurogroup, I contested a decision made by its president. And I contested the legality of that decision. And he turned around and he said, oh, I can do it. And I put my hand up again and said, excuse me, I would like a legal opinion from the Secretariat as to whether this is true. I'm a Minister of Finance. I belong to the Eurogroup. I have the right to ask for legal advice from the Eurogroup Secretariat. There was a kerfuffle for about 10, 15 minutes. They were sort of talking on the phone and trying to find out what to answer. And the official answer came. And the official answer was, lo and behold, Minister, the Eurogroup does not exist in law. It's not mentioned in any European Union treaty. It's an informal meeting. And therefore, its president can do anything he likes. So, what Schäuble wants to do, I've written an article in a German newspaper on this, he wants to formalize it, to turn the president of the Eurogroup into a, if you want, a federal treasurer, And he wants to create a Euro chamber that legitimizes him by having some kind of democratic process, a possibility of keeping checks and balances on him or her. But this person, this treasurer, will be binary, will be digital, 0-1, a 0-1 person. Because there is no real federation, there's no real budget for the Eurozone, what do you do as a treasury when you don't have a budget? You're binary. You can say two words only, yes or no. So Schäuble's idea is national governments submit their budgets to the treasurer, the fiscal leviathan, who says, okay, yes or no, turning it back. Effectively, Schäuble is interested in controlling the French national budget and having veto power over it. But that's not a democracy either. So it is very clear that the path that we're on has two diverges into, we're at a juncture. Either we disband it, and you know what? The boy in me, the angry little person in me, says, I'll just disband this terrible thing, just do away with it. Like lots of you here in Britain say, we've had enough of this EU, let's get rid of it. But the more sophisticated version of me says, no. Because if we disband it, we're going to end up in a great depression, not just in Greece, but throughout Europe, and forces of evil are going to triumph if that happens. So we need to find ways of stabilizing Europe and creating a groundswell where we are all going to turn our anger at the democratic deficit into a movement for the purpose of demanding genuine checks and balances, a genuine parliamentary process at the level of Europe.
This is the plan B that you've been talking about with other European politicians.
I don't like to call it plan B. I like to call it plan A, plan Z.
But I mean, what I'm saying, Yanis, is how real is
actually,
that?
Actually, it's plan A.
It's an aspiration. A. Who's signed up to it? Who is already signed up? What are you going to do? You sit on a platform and convince people, but what tangibly can you do going forward?
Okay. How about agreeing, all of us together here, people in Berlin, I spoke to similarly sized, wonderful audience in Berlin, which is astonishing, and they were Germans, they were not Greek migrants. Similarly in Barcelona, in Portugal, there is a thirst and a hunger for something extremely radical to happen in Europe, like, for instance, democracy. So this. It's a very radical idea. If you think about democracy is the rule by the underprivileged. Because the underprivileged are a majority. To the extent that democracy is based on majority rule, we should have a system where the underprivileged wield political power. But that's a philosophical question. What should we be doing? What should we agree upon? What does this process of democratizing Europe mean? Well, how about agreeing on what we should demand for next week, for the next 6 months, for the next 2 years, and for the next decade. And let me just flesh this out very briefly. I would like us to demand collectively, as European citizens, that we shall all agree that every time Cameron, Tsipras, Merkel meet, that their meetings should be live-streamed, and we should be able to listen to what they say. How about that? How about demanding that the European Central Bank governing board meetings record minutes which are then published on the internet?
It's like a clapometer.
We don't need new institutions or treaties for this. We can agree this for next week, tomorrow. How about publishing on the internet all the chapters of the TPP trade discussions? Because an informed body politic is a powerful body politic which disempowers those politicians who are running agendas against the interest of the majority. That's the first step. We can do it tomorrow. Next 6 months, how about demanding that the existing European institutions that we have, like the European Investment Bank, which is a splendid institution that very few people know about, and which can be deployed in order to create a new European green, a Green New Deal, that is a new deal for channeling investment in green technologies. Why can't we use the European Investment Bank for that? And why can't we have quantitative easing using the ECB instead of purchasing mortgages, instead of purchasing assets of the banks, which effectively feed into asset price inflation without feeding into genuine investments into the real economy? Why can't the ECB or the Bank of England in this country purchase these investment bank bonds that go straight into the new technologies, straight into good quality jobs, straight into genuine growth of the things that must grow, like green energy, and degrowth of the things that must shrink?
You pose these as a very effective set of rhetorical questions, but you know the answer because you have run up. Your book is The Global Minotaur, and as I described it in the intro to it, you have vaulted that Minotaur. It is the elite that controls this system that is absolutely opposed to all of these things. And you yourself observed close up a very committed and, I would argue, sincere political party fail in the face of it. Mm-hmm. So what for this to not be a set of nice ideas, what are we going to do about those who will stand in the way of that?
Do you remember how the Soviet Union and its satellites collapsed?
I do.
Do you remember the way in which the groundswell of public opinion, of civil society in Eastern Europe, effectively neutered the rejection, yeah, the rejectionism and the oppression and the tendency of those regimes to go on and on and on? It was a velvet revolution. I believe that there are lots of people in Whitehall, next door, in Brussels, in the various seats of government around Europe, conservative people, people who have bought the neoliberal mantra, who believe that what they are doing is right, who are not bad people. But they are caught up in a kind of sort of a network of myths. And also, partly, they are fueled by their desire to emulate the model of a successful bureaucrat, which they know. So the banality of evil, in other words. Yeah? If we get together as Democrats and start becoming more demanding of the people who rule over us, a lot of these good people will be liberated from the idiocy which rules over their lives on a daily basis.
Okay. Speaking of all that, Britain. You alluded to we've got a referendum coming up on Euro membership, mm-hmm, European Union membership. We had in 2014 the Scottish referendum where, you know, sort of when offered the chance to leave the oldest imperial power and the first neoliberal economy in the world, a large minority of Scots said yes, please, for free. What do you see British politics? What do you see the challenges in British politics for the next 6, 12, 18 months?
Well, I think that your relationship, the relationship of this country with Europe, is far more important than many people think. Let's not forget that Britain is wholly dependent for its trade on the European Union.
Well, it's declined, though. It has markedly declined, the trade share.
Only because Europe is shrinking. And you're not.
Right.
So the significance of Europe seems to be... But still. If Britain leaves the European Union, and I can understand why you may want to go, I'm not the greatest advertisement, as Paul said, of what's going on in Brussels. Hearing me describe what, you know, the goings-on there does not make you want to rush out there and prepare for voting to stay in the European Union. But if you leave, what are you going to achieve? Firstly, these days, free trade is not about the absence of tariffs and quotas. These days, mainly tariffs are very low anyway. The whole point about the free trade agreements and the single market in Europe concerns labor standards, it concerns environmental standards, and it concerns industrial standards. These will be determined by Brussels anyway. So do you want to be out of there and not have an input on the standards that determine the parameters of your own trade, your own industry? I don't think it would be... In other words, you're not going to manage to extricate yourself from Brussels simply by voting to get out. Secondly, listening to people in pubs in this country talk about Europe, I get this feeling that there is a great deal of discontent in this country, which is caused by things that are happening in this country, but then is transferred, is projected onto Brussels. Brussels has a lot to answer for, but the average person in the pub who keeps blaming everything on Brussels is going to be mightily disappointed after a referendum that brings Britain out of the European Union. Thirdly, you can kiss Scotland goodbye if you vote to leave the European Union, which may be a good thing for Scotland. But those Tories in particular who disdain Brussels and they're thinking of supporting the leave the EU vote, they will have another thing coming from Scotland. By the way, there's a delicious irony in the conservative opposition to the idea of a democratic Europe to which Britain should belong. The Burkean viewpoint of the Tory tradition, which I respect actually quite a lot, is that a nation must reflect a particular culture, a linguistic tradition. There must be a one-to-one correspondence between culture, nation, and a currency. And therefore, we don't want a single currency. We don't want to be part of the euro. We cannot accept that there will be powers in Brussels that usurp the powers of parliament, because parliament, parliamentary power, nationhood, and currency must be contained on a one-to-one basis. Now, if you believe that, then you can't possibly believe that the Scots are a nation, unless you support Scottish independence. So the Tories are caught up in a philosophical antinomy. If they want to use this Burkean argument in order to claim that Britain should get out of the European Union, they must accept Scottish independence, unless they look the Scots in the eye and say, we don't think you are a bona fide nation.
And you personally would welcome Scottish independence?
Personally, I would. Personally, I would, in the context of a united Europe.
What do you make of Corbyn? Did that surprise you?
Pleasantly. Of course it surprised me. It surprised Corbyn. As if I wasn't going to be surprised. But look, what does not surprise me is the deep discontent that various populations around the world have against the toxic consensus around the proposition that during the good times, there should be a constant trickle-up effect from the have-nots to the haves. When this trickle-up effect creates a financial crisis and bubbles that burst, again, the have-nots must bear the cost of salvaging the haves, the 1%, the 0.1%, and that this is a natural law that must be respected by all well-thinking people. This consensus is imploding. It has imploded in Canada the other day. It is imploding in Europe. It's the reason why we were elected in Greece. This view that there is no alternative to a financialized process which is designed to fail with extreme human costs, this consensus is going, it is fragmenting. The difficulty that Corbyn has, and that we had, and progressive forces have, is to pull ourselves together and to come up with a plan that can convince the discontented that we mean business and that we can do a better job at guiding and steering society towards a better future.
I mean, I had a fairly close look at Syriza in its first days in power, and it had a few hiccups. It was unorthodox. It's not often you can ring up the finance ministry and get through to the finance minister. It doesn't happen with George Osborne. You tend to get through to a PA or a press office. But what would your advice be to Corbyn? Because, I mean, compared to Syriza, Syriza looked quite competent and professional in its first few days, and Corbyn, as we know, and McDonnell and the rest of it. I mean, they are a minority in a large parliamentary party that, you know, without revealing too many secrets, hates their guts. So what should they do?
Desist from seeking answers in the past and escape straight into the technological future.
Go on.
Look, Harold Wilson in the 1960s, after the Gaitskill era, which was the Tony Blair era of the time, Harold Wilson managed to revive the Labour Party by blending with the traditional Labour values from the 1920s onwards an agenda for pushing Britain into the future in the white heat of technology, as he used to say. Whether he succeeded to do all this or not is another matter. But there were success stories, and he managed to capture the attention and inspire the nation, and many of us outside Britain. Corbyn has this opportunity. It would not be the white heat of technology, because this is environmentally improper. It should be the cool breeze of green technologies, of decentralizing technologies, of internet-based technologies. He has to combine his splendid idea of a people's QE with a QE that, as I was mentioning before, uses the power of the Bank of England to support a genuine state-funded investment drive into the new technologies, but to do it in a way that, yes, it funds large infrastructural programs, like, for instance, energy programs, but also at the same time provides venture capital to the young people who are not in this room today because they don't give a damn about politics. Their only objective is to create the next killer app that will make them millionaires. But unless we of the left manage to inspire them and to make them understand that they live in a collectivity whether they like it or not, and their killer app, even if it succeeds, will only be meaningful, and their lives will be meaningful if it becomes part and parcel of a society which uses technology in order to create happiness that can only be created in the end collectively. Unless Jeremy Corbyn, the Corbynistas, all of us, manage to combine those values of collectivity and of collective action and of looking after each other with the decentralizing power of latest technological innovation, we will fail.
So you're in favor of an active monetary policy that takes political control back over monetary policy and the central bank. I think our central bank has made it fairly clear he would not be hanging around long if that were to happen.
We've had one
foreign central banker. If you got the call to be Britain's...
I don't buy that. You see, bring him here. I don't think he can say this in front of me. Because, you know, the Bank of England has been printing billions upon billions upon billions. So I'm not suggesting something that they're not doing it.
No, but what Carney says is that Carney has gone on record as being critical of the sort of active monetary policy that Corbyn and MacDonald have.
But he's doing it. You can't get more activist than him.
Yeah, but he's not a politician. No, my question was simply, you know, suppose you did get the call. You know, you're a senior economist. You've seen the elephant of power. If Corbyn asked you to be the next governor of the Bank of England, would you fancy that?
I would advise him against it. For a very simple reason. You know how money markets are. They look at the left winger and they abandon ship. So, no. In Greece, if I was to choose the next central banker in Greece, if I were still a finance minister, I would probably choose a British conservative monetarist. But his brief on what to do would be written by us. I actually recommended that. But look, what I would say to Khan is this. Let's agree that we're not just going to print money and give it to the poor. Because his argument, his technical argument, is that what he's been doing all these years, him and his predecessor, King, what they were doing was they actually bought assets from private sector banks, pieces of paper of value. And they did it in order to support liquidity and credit provision. But the Bank of England had those assets, so at least in theory, they could sell them back to the private sector to get their money back. And that's not the same thing as printing money and giving it away. It's okay, fine. Mr. Carnell disagreed that we're going to carry on doing that. Now, but why do these pieces of paper that you buy, why do they have to be mortgages? Because by buying mortgages, what you're doing is you're pushing house prices up in London. Where is the wisdom of that? Why can't these pieces of paper be bonds of the investment bank that go into the green technologies? He can't answer back. There is no reason why he should choose mortgages over investment bonds that go straight into production and which are not inflationary. Because if, look, you now have in this country to renationalize the electricity power generation system. You have already done it. Of course, it was the wrong nation that did it. It was the French nation and the Chinese nation. Okay? In the process, do you know what you've lost? You've lost the technological spillovers from having homegrown R&D, like the Chinese have and the French have. So Jeremy Corbyn, as Prime Minister, he should look in. You know, he should have a nice conversation with Mr. Carney and say, "I'm not asking you to do anything different from what you're doing, except what pieces of paper you buy. Don't buy those that are making the rich richer, and which inflate asset prices without increasing the investment that would give rise to a greater productivity in this nation." By the way, your productivity is chronic in this country. Buy the ones that increase productivity, create jobs, and allow us to go back on the forefront of technological innovation where this country used to be for so many decades.
Thank you. We've spilled over a bit in the time we were supposed to allocate ourselves to discuss, and now it's time for you, the audience, to ask questions. The way it works is this: if you put your hand up and I see you and call you, you're supposed to go to a microphone which will be pointed out to you. Please don't spontaneously start queuing at the mics without me asking you to, otherwise it'll be chaos. Would anybody like to, and apologies to everybody for whom both I and Yanis are sitting with our backs to you, it's an inevitable Methodist thing apparently. So would anybody like to ask a question?
It's not working.
Right.
It's not working?
Oh, yes, it is now.
I'm small. Over the summer, you met with Arnaud de Montebourg in France, and you talk about the creation of a progressive alliance in Europe to refound or reform the Eurozone. You also found out, as a finance minister, that it's very, very difficult to leave the monetary union, that it might have destructive impact over Greece, and I believe that many other European countries have reached that conclusion. So my question is, do you envisage a reform of the monetary union along progressive lines? What should left-wing parties, socialists and radical left parties like Syriza, should do? What kind of things they should demand in terms of reforms of the monetary union?
Before you answer, Yanis, would the next woman there go and queue up there as well? Thank you. Sir, and I'm going to give you two questions to answer at a time.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a double question. From what Yanis says, If you were miraculously become Prime Minister of Greece now, would you fight to stay in the euro and sort of get live streaming and pipe dreams like that, or would you just leave and go to the drachma? Right. That's one question. Wait a minute. Yeah. And I want to ask Paul, if there was a referendum tomorrow on staying or leaving the EU, what would your vote be?
Yanis, what do you think?
Well, the first question. We have the euro on the continent. Its fragmentation, if we leave, as you said, that I might be doing, given the opportunity, do you know what would happen if the euro fragments? We're going to end up with a new Berlin Wall, only this time it will be running down the Rhine and the Alps. There will be a division of Europe between a Germanic part, east of the Rhine and north of the Alps. That part is going to sink into a very serious recession and deflation because its currency, the new Deutschmark, is going to appreciate massively. They will already have lost China because China has slowed down. The currency will go up. You're going to end up with this conversion of working poor Germans into unemployed poor Germans. In the rest of the continent, you're going to have both high inflation because of the depreciation of those currencies and high unemployment. This will be catastrophic for Britain, let alone for the rest of the world. So we don't want that. We want to save the euro. Especially those of us who are very critical of the euro. Do we need to reform it? Reform is too mild a word. We need to transform it. We want to transform the eurozone from a democracy-free zone, which is quite idiotic in the way that it's been pursuing its economic, social, and policies, into a Europe that where power is subjected to the checks and balances of a democratic body politic. Now that is, some people say to me, but that sounds utopian. Well, maybe it does. But so did the idea that there would be a world without slaves a couple of centuries ago. In politics, you have to imagine that which you think is the only alternative to the present conundrum. On your questions, would I want to go to the drachma? No, I wouldn't want to go to the drachma for the reason that I just outlined. But at the same time, I would never sign on the dotted line of another extend and pretend loan. I would never pretend to be implementing rules that cannot be implemented. And what I would do is I would say that our position is, this is what I was saying, we're never going to get out of the euro on our own. If you dare, chuck us out. You have no legal instruments for doing it. This is why they shut down the banks. We shall create a parallel payment system in euros in order to resist your attempts to force us to borrow from your taxpayers money that we know we cannot return. Had we done that, we would have been able to resist. But the reason why I'm not running now, I could have created a political party in Greece and go that way. I think that in Greece we had a window of an opportunity which we wasted. That window has now shut. But what the snuffing out of the Greek resistance, of the Athens Spring, as I call it, contributed to Europe is this. I go to France, you mentioned France, I go to Portugal, I go to Germany, I go to various places. And thousands of people want to talk to me and to colleagues of mine. Why? Not out of solidarity for Greece. Because they are worried about themselves. Because they know that Greece is a cruel laboratory in which misanthropic and inefficient policies are being tried and tested before transferred to France, transferred to Portugal, transferred to parts of Germany, to social classes within Germany. And these people are very worried because they can see that the European project is dying. Therefore, if you're asking me what I would want to do now, I'm telling you what I am doing. I'm trying to cause mischief throughout Europe in order to solidify a groundswell of a movement that will demand the democratization in the center, not in the periphery.
If you keep...
If you keep your questions snappy, we might get another three in. Sir, you, and then a woman down here, please. Are you?
And I'll try to keep my answers snappy, yeah, too.
Okay, great. Yeah. Mine's so snappy that I didn't answer you. Okay, so there you
go. Hi.
Where are you?
I'll keep the question concise.
Go on.
I think it's probably no coincidence that a founding member of Syriza is sitting on a platform talking about Jeremy Corbyn as opposed to any other British politician. Plus Paul Mason, who talks about future left projects, technology in his own work. So my question is for two people who are figureheads of a new left thought, what would you say to someone that wishes to participate in that movement across Europe? How do you become more actively involved in supporting this new way of thinking and this challenge to establishment politics? Join the Labour Party, a trade union? What's your advice to someone that wishes to step forward?
And your question, ma'am.
So I read in an interview to El País, the Spanish newspaper, that you had apologized to Podemos after Tsipras changing his policy. So first I wanted to ask if that was true, because nowadays we cannot always believe what El País says.
Don't believe what the newspapers
Good point.
Are,
don't yeah. believe the newspapers. On this occasion, it was true.
El País. And then my related question is whether you think the decline or at least the stagnation that Podemos is having in the polls right now, how much is it influenced by what happened with Greece after the referendum? Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
We'll come to you.
On the first question, look, we must act at the municipal level, at the trade union level, at our students' union level, at the local government level, at the national government level, and at the European level. What I am saying when I go around Europe, here in London and elsewhere, to those who ask questions like yours, a very pertinent question is, firstly, don't give up on politics. Politics is the only chance we have to civilize the economy in which we live and effectively to save the planet as well, because we have the ecological crisis as well that can only be resolved through politics. The European network or movement that we are creating is open to everyone independently of which political party they belong to. So, by all means, if you are a left-winger, join the Corbynistas. If you are an honest liberal or libertarian, join us too. And fight within the Tory party, if you are in the Tory party or the Lib Dems or wherever you are, to demand more transparency and more democracy, even in the context of your own ideology. On the question regarding Spain. Oh, by the way, yes, let me confirm that I did apologize to the people of Spain and to Podemos for the fact that we surrendered. By surrendering, we dealt a massive blow at them. Prime Minister Rajoy of Spain, on that despicable day, the day that will remain as a blot on European history, when European leaders tortured the Greek Prime Minister to extract from him a dishonorable, non-viable agreement on the 13th of July. On that day, Prime Minister Rajoy of Spain, just in order to confirm our interpretation of why our government was snuffed out, appeared on television in Spain with the agreement that the Greek government just signed, the surrender document, and said, "This is what you get if you vote for Spain's Syriza. This is why we were crushed. It is a sad day in Europe when a proud nation is crushed in order to win an election somewhere else." So I did apologize. Now, Podemos made mistakes. The reason why they're waning the polls is partly to do with our surrender, for which I apologized on behalf of those of us who surrendered. But Podemos also made mistakes. I believe that they pinned their colors on our mast when they shouldn't have done it. We should have been walking together, and I'm very pleased that Podemos and Syriza were walking together. But I think that Podemos should have sent a signal to the Spanish people, differentiating themselves from Greece. Why? Spain is bigger. Spain is more significant. What Pablo Iglesias should have said to the Spaniards is, from the beginning, not now, well, now would be a good time to start, but it would have been far more effective had he done it last year, that Spain is not Greece. We are in solidarity with our comrades in Greece. We hope this is fantastic what they are doing, and we hope that they succeed. But let us not forget that Spain has a debt which is 1 trillion euros, and it cannot be set aside or cast away the way that Schäuble was thinking of cast away Greece. We, the Spanish, have a lot more bargaining power. We have a manufacturing base which is very significant compared to Greece that has none, especially after 5 years of depletion. And we are going to be playing an active role with Italy, with France, with all the others, but we're going to be leaders, and the Spanish people have an opportunity by electing us to multiply by multiple factor whatever Syriza is doing in Greece. And even if Syriza is crushed, we are not going to be.
And before I take the other question, thank you. Keep them snappy. I will add, because somebody asked me something, but I will add one thing about that, and that is, as somebody who's covered both movements and both political situations, the first act of Tsipras in power was to go to the Greek war memorial to the victims of Nazism in Kasariani in Athens and pay his respects. I've been to the place where hundreds of people were shot outside Valencia by Franco, and there is no monument. There's beer cans strewn around it. And I think many of people I know in the Spanish polity, not just people who support Podemos, but also people in the PSOE, are worried about what the Spanish state will do, both to Barcelona, to Catalonia, and to a left government. I observed your situation close up. I was never concerned that the Greek deep state was going to move against you, certainly in the 6 months that we saw it. I didn't think it was there. But I
mean that the army?
Well, but
the deep state is not the army anymore. Exactly. The deep state is the media, the toxic television channels, the bankers, the bankrupt bankers that we keep supporting through bailout loans that the Greek weak taxpayers are getting on their behalf, and the oligarchs who are controlling procurement.
Yeah. Well, they did move against you, but you know, the armed force didn't.
They really turned against us.
Sir, and then your question, ma'am.
I'll keep it short because I haven't eaten all day. would you agree that the greatest threat to progress of the European left is the media, which seems to have a agenda very much against yourselves in Greece, Corbyn over here from the Mail, the Express, even the Guardian, sorry, to an extent? That's it.
Your question.
This is all well and good, but I think it's a little too little too late. Don't you think you could have done more when you were part of a government that said, you know, we're going to tear up the memoranda? I mean, you couldn't have been just the only voice in the desert. And also, what do you have to say to the Greeks who have left Greece and have come to the UK and Germany and elsewhere, not only young people, but people with families as well, that were disappointed by Syriza, and maybe that's why they voted, less people voted in September?
Okay, we'll take this woman up there to ask your quick question, and then we'll let Yanis answer the last one.
Okay. Okay, I'll try and make it as quick as possible. So, one of the several economists who are saying that the problem isn't necessarily with not enough investment, but not enough demand, not enough aggregate demand. And the phenomenon that Greece was at the sharp end of was essentially Germany solving that problem by having you guys take on the debt and them exporting, so accessing demand otherwise. So bearing in mind that the problem might just be that there's not enough money in people's pockets, I would like you to comment on the idea that it's not just investment we need, but one of those old ideas you were talking about, which is redistribution.
Okay, I'll start from the last one and then move on.
You can sit down.
The issue you're raising is central to the problem that the whole world is facing, not just Greece or the Eurozone. This is a problem here, it's a problem in the United States. Look, a crisis like the one we've had after 1929 and the one we had after 2008 creates two mountains. A mountain of debts and losses, which is the one that we keep talking about the debt crisis. But there is another mountain that we did not talk about, which is equally important. It's a mountain of idle savings. That is too much cash accumulated, which is idle. Why is it idle? Because those who have it, the rich never had it so good as they have it during a crisis. If you look at the accumulated savings of the rich, they have never been so high. But these are the two sides of the same coin, the mountain of debts and the mountain of idle savings. Now, why is it idle? Why doesn't it get invested? This is the problem. The problem is, why are these two mountains staying so tall? Because the idle savings do not get invested into economic activities that will produce the incomes which will allow the debts to be repaid. So the problem is investment. Lack of investment. And the aggregate demand scarcity that you refer to is due to the fact that people don't have enough money in their pockets because the incomes are not generated, and they're not generated because investment is not created. So what you need to do during that crisis, this kind of crisis, is to find a way of channeling those idle, just pushing those idle savings into productive activities that will generate the income so people can have money in their pockets. This is why I was talking about a QE that would focus on investments, but on what? On things that are good for society and for the planet. That's my answer to this question.
And on the what? There was a gone about the media.
On the media. Look, I don't believe there is anyone in this room that has suffered a character assassination attempt by the media as much as I have over the last year. I had astonishing experiences. I had a major Italian newspaper that interviewed me. It actually was a very good interview. Except at that point, at one point, there was a question that was put to me. This is just one of millions of examples, right? The question was put to me, Minister, what are your plans for exiting the Eurozone? I said, I don't want to discuss something that doesn't exist. Yeah? And I thought I ended it. Next day, the interview was published, but the headline on the front page was, Greek Minister of Finance refuses to discuss his plans for Grexit. Yeah? So, this is exactly it. Corbyn is copying it. He will cop it a lot more if he starts going up in the polls. We copped it. I copped it. But you know what the good news is? That if you have a good, decent program, if you have something to say to people that is well thought out, it has a beginning, a middle, and an end, if it excites them, if it talks to them about the future and not just about the past, and if you are steadfast in your position, you do not play games, if you don't spin, and you continue to do this against the assaults by the media, and you do not answer back, at some point the people out there start ignoring the media. We did this in Greece. Do you know, on the 5th of July, we had a referendum. There wasn't one television station, one newspaper, except for the Syriza Party official newspaper, one outlet that supported the no. Every single journalistic outfit was bombarding citizens, voters, through the newspapers, inside their living room, out of the idiot box, with stories of Armageddon if they dared vote no. They had the powers that be throughout Europe telling them that they would be confined to hell if they dare vote no. And they voted no 62%. We managed to do that which citizens suffering under the Soviet Union did. Remember, under the Soviet Union, the press was completely directed by propaganda, the television was directed by propaganda, nobody listened to it. No one listened to it. This is what we must achieve. We achieved this in Greece. No one paid attention to the media. This is the greatest revenge you can exact upon the media.
Well, Yanis, because our time in this wonderful place of worship, which it still is up. We only have it until now. We do have to cut the discussion short there. I know there's loads and loads of people who want to ask questions. Unfortunately, you can't. He's on Twitter. Tweet him. Tweet me and I'll try and get an answer for you. This has been live streamed on The Guardian Live. It is watchable again. I'm sure there's a massive discussion going on about it. Right. I'm sorry. Go on then. It was quickly, briefly. What should young Greeks do? And were you the only person? What more could you have done?
What could I have done? Well, Larry Summers, the former U.S. Secretary of the Treasury, who became quite close to me during that period, and we worked together. And by the way, in the book that you referred to, in the Global Minotaur, I said this to him when we met in Washington. I said to him, by the way, let me warn you about something, Larry, because I'm sure you haven't read my book. He said, no, I haven't read your book. Well, in that book, I refer to you as the Prince of Darkness. Because he was responsible for the deregulation of the financial services in Wall Street. Yeah? But nevertheless, it's a long story how and why he became helpful. The short version of the answer is that, you know, Americans can be quite pragmatic and at some point recognize that there can be common interests with the left-wing government that's trying to stop the self-defeating idiocy of austerity. He said to me, you know, Yanis, you made a very big mistake. I said, what, Larry? He said, you won the election. So I'm not going to say that I would have changed that, but what I would have changed was, firstly, I would have been a lot more vigilant about people on my team who ended up, in the end, betraying us. Secondly, I would have made sure that...
These are civil servants.
No.
Okay.
Don't ask me further questions on this. Secondly, and even more importantly, I entered the political sphere believing that the powers that be, those people that you see on your television set representing mighty institutions like the central bank, like the IMF, like the commission, that when you reach an agreement with them and you shake hands, it will be difficult to get to that point. But if you get to that point, then it must mean that they are people of honor and that they mean that handshake. They don't.
With that, I will simply say, Yanis's book, The Global Minotaur, the new edition of it, is on sale outside. You'd be very well advised to read it. It's a brilliant book. It's a brilliant introduction by me. And we will not hear the last of the former Greek Finance Minister, Yanis Varoufakis. Thank you.
Thank you.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.